We've had a very moving and important descriptions and interpretations of what is going on with the TRC, which show that TRCs are a little piece in a much broader environment. So I would want, we have less than half an hour for comments, questions. Let us make them very brief, and so that we have, and we can continue then through lunch, in further conversation.
For several decades, we've been told that the undisputed success of Truth and Reconciliation Commissions have been to prevent massive bloodshed and violent anarchy. I wonder whether in reality, instead of civil war and anarchy, what has often been prevented are more genuine revolutions of real attempts to transform these societies. And so my question to the panel, though, is, can you come up with any realistic assessment of what the possible dangers for civil war and violent anarchy did exist at the time that these commissions came into being? Because, in other words, how much of it do you think is genuine? How much of it is propaganda for one reason or another? I don't have the answer. I'm asking the question.
Well, one of the things I didn't go into really, which was interesting, which was the causes of the war, and I think that's one of the roles of the TRC usually is to try to figure out what is the cause of war. And in Sierra Leone, people, you know, thought about blood diamonds. Of course, there were movies produced about that. And then, of course, there was the infamous Charles Taylor, and it was all his fault. But actually, the TRC said no. They said those were fueling factors, but the actual problem basically was political exclusion, lack of public transparency, corruption, and a lack of basic human rights. So that those that the seeds were there for a massive revolution, or I guess it ended up being a civil war. And there was also that real division that existed before any of this with the colony, which was Freetown, and then the hinterland, which is everything else. And so I think the seeds for the war was there before the TRC. And I think the TRC really propelled Sierra Leone into better governance by, number one, in putting the focus squarely on that as a cause and saying, you know, you've got youth that are particularly marginalized and feel not a part of what's happening, and so they just easily have their arms twisted to get into a violent thing. They have nothing to lose. So I guess that's my point. I don't know if you have anything else.
Do you want
to? Well, no, not civil war in the scope of or in the scenario of Argentina in 1984, but however, never again, I think that prevented possible tendency to revenge of the relatives of the disappeared, and was part of a process of transformation of the role of the army forces in the political scenario in Argentina. And in this case, prevent these forces not civil war.
May I say something regarding this? I think that what we heard about the commission reports and the specific institution of TRC, not the broader, is that it covered a limited time period, and also it defined a range of violations that it was going to deal with. We saw four different types of violations. Here, only disappeared in the case of Argentina. In the case of Chile, it was assassinated and disappeared people first, and 15 years later, there was a commission on torture. So there is a definition of violations and there is a definition of a time period. And what I'm hearing here is that there are structures of inequality and structures of exclusion that go way before the time period that is being covered, and that cover many more violations than the ones that are covered in the TRC. So in a sense, to what extent isn't it almost an institution that can never be successful? Because we know that it's in a context in which there are limits to how much of that context is taken into consideration. But that's so...
My question is somewhat related, which is when we take this larger temporal perspective and then we ask the question, okay, what is the role of TRCs to democracy building, or in the case of South Africa, I believe it was that you, no, sorry, Emilio, you said in the case of Argentina, the idea was peace building, right, in this transitional period. So we have this long period of time, 30 years, and so we can reflect upon, well, has it helped us build democracy? And so listening to the three papers, one gets a sense, well, in the case of South Africa, we have a really weak democracy. Ms. Carrick, you sound pretty positive about the impact of the TRC and the Sierra Leone case. And I imagine, Emilio, if you had continued on, we would have gotten the sense of this much longer process of transitional justice that keeps repeating. And whether that's the equation that will lead us to a more sustained democracy if we keep repeating this exercise of transitional justice through different institutional mechanisms. So I just want you to reflect maybe on the idea of a TRC as leading us to democracy, and perhaps that's something that we should reconsider as a goal of a TRC. Quick question, Ms. Carrick, I'd like to know, you talk about the positive impact of the TRC on children, specifically on children. This is 10 years ago now, so these children are no longer children, so I'd like to know what the lasting impact of that was on their lives. Thank you.
That's a very good question, and on my recent trip, I have to admit, for some reason, I guess because I was thinking about presenting here, I was kept looking sideways at every person that was from about basically, I guess, 25 to 30, but 25 to 35 kind of thing, because they would have been 15 at the time. And because you know what was really interesting is that very quickly after the war ended, no one wanted to be identified as a child soldier. In fact, we had people say, could you take off, they had been engraved onto their skin that they were RUF, and they said, I can't take my shirt off. Is there anything we can do about that? So very quickly, no one wanted to be seen as a child soldier. So it's actually hard to know now who are child soldiers, and because they won't admit to it. So I don't know really quite how to tell you that. The ones that I do know, I think they've done okay. They're still living with ghosts. I think there's the PDSP, kind of thing there that still haunts them. But there's still a lot of youth unemployment. Are some of those children or some of those youth former child soldier? They aren't being violent at the moment, fortunately. So hard to say, sorry. Oh, sorry, and I may have that, the post-traumatic stress syndrome. Yeah, so that, thank you, okay.
Let's take a couple of questions and then if they go in there.
Okay, this is more referred to the theme that you had, the trend set, setting the trend. And there's a common characteristic of all of these processes. They're national. They look at a local event and it happened in time, and we're hearing that they're in contexts that are more complex, but they're very useful because we're putting truth, we're documenting it. For example, in the case of Argentina, that process did not happen only at a national level. I'm a survivor of a concentration camp in Argentina. I was in Campo de Mayo. And when I was freed, because of my nationality, most of my friends died, close to maybe 30,000. I did a process in the U.S. that was lobbying to cut military aid. And in the list of the things that aid was being given to, there was one that said interrogation techniques. That's financing torture. Military aid was cut. But now, as these processes have gone on in the countries, they're local. And we know that there was international intervention to support those military dictatorships in Brazil, in Chile. We maybe need to set a trend that makes these commissions also go internationally. Do we know of examples? So the question is this in process somewhere?
You want to answer?
Yes, it's true. The Never Again report refers briefly on the national security doctrine that involved the repression in the southern cone of, and they guide the repression in the southern cone of Latin America, but also identify the particular clandestine detention center, Automotores Orleti, where disappeared, where was the where stayed disappeared of the southern cone. But it's true. I think that in the way to not attend to the political and historical context, the political and cultural factors and regional and extra-regional powers, the Commission not talk about so much about these interventions and these political and ideological factors that contribute to the state terrorism and in particular to the forced disappearance.
No, not on that particular issue, but I don't want to give the impression that the Truth Commission in South Africa was not very, very important. It had very serious constraints. It started very soon after our transition, and it worked for a very short time. And so we're at the point where politicians are contesting elections in May, trying to raise these issues on the agendas of all the political parties, because there has to be a commitment to going back and picking up. You know, we were on a journey that we thought was going to bring us the kind of society we wanted, and I think people were really exhausted by the length of the struggle that was that ran in South Africa, and there was this hope that now we've got these people into power, they will do what they've committed to do. And of course you can never do that, so that's the hard lesson. And I think that's the contribution especially of a Kulumani, because the Kulumani membership are those people who made these sacrifices and stood for justice. And so our process is one of reactivating that capacity to lead at local level, because politicians are not coping. People deployed into local government are deployed because they are loyal to the party, not to the citizens. So we have to fix the mess we're in. And I just didn't want to leave the impression that the TRC was a failed project. I think the citizen vigilance was lacking in ensuring we achieved a better outcome. And we are looking at the call by Mahmoud Mamdani and Sampieter Blanche and Drusilla Cornell for a new Justice and Reconciliation Commission, which primarily looks at the economic issues which have undermined our democracy.
Hi. My question is mostly directed at Ms. Jobson. So you spoke about the need for white adult education in South Africa, and it's my understanding that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission there did not have the ability to subpoena people to come testify. It was all voluntary, and that most of the testifying people were from the ANC side and not from the perpetrating side. So to what extent do you think that is what's caused the lack of reconciliation and the need for that adult education? And how do you think, like, what strategies do you think you need to take on to be able to get people who don't want to cooperate with you to be part of that reconciliation?
That is one of the challenges, that so few people who committed these crimes came forward. But the big gap for us is the fact that when the TRC concluded its business, it had files on 350 people who committed these crimes, and they were handed over to our national prosecuting authority, and only one of those cases has been prosecuted, because, I mean, the understanding is that actually there were offenders and perpetrators of crimes on all sides of this conflict. But for victims' sake, we are pursuing, trying to get some of these prosecutions back onto the agenda, because it's only in those trials that the truth has really emerged, and there's a vast lack of people knowing the truth. We haven't been able to get access to all the Section 27 hearings, amnesty hearings, which were in-camera hearings. Our Minister of Justice promised to hand over the records of those hearings, and we're now going to court to try and get those records, having been told for 2 years by our minister that they are now going to be in the public domain. So these issues are very, you have to keep working at them. It's a long road.
Audrey, I actually wanted to pick up on your more optimistic note towards the end, because at least my sense from your presentation was one of almost total pessimism. And I think that one can make a case, although South Africans like myself who've lived out of the country for a long time are often much more optimistic about the place than those who live within. I think one can make a case that it's actually extraordinary how strong the institutions of democracy are in South Africa. Think about it. There's been a one-party state since 1996. And the people who are in charge of that state, most notably the most recent leadership of the ANC, have shown a fair amount of determination to get rid of democracy, to undermine the institutions of democracy, to undermine the courts. And yet South African civil society remains remarkably resilient. And why does it remain remarkably resilient? Well, because I think a foundation was laid between 1993 and 96 for such resilience, for people to resist using democratic means. You spoke just a moment ago about going to court to get these records. And what's more, I think one can say that the promises that were made in the Constitution, the promise that was held out by the TRC, stand as a kind of constant rebuke to the ANC governments when it comes to their poor record. And calling it a poor record, I think, is being kind, because lately it's become a record of rampant self-enrichment and corruption. So perhaps one should try to make a little bit more of the sense of optimism that there are the resources in place, and that what happened between 93 and, say, 98 actually helped to make it possible for organizations like Kulamani to fight back against the failures of the South African state.
Yes, I'm sorry if people felt it was that pessimistic, but there are very serious red flags flying, and having served on one of our institutions to support and consolidate democracy, I can give you some inside experience of what happens when there's political interference, and that is the problem, and managing that has become very serious. There's a huge breakdown of trust among citizens in many of the institutions. We deal with cases of ongoing torture, and in most provinces those who are tortured will not go and report to the Independent Police Investigative Directorate because of their connections with the people who commit these crimes. So we have to fight to not to lose the integrity of our institutions. I mean, the shining example is the example of the public protector. She is the one person that the entire country rests their hope on, and I mean, her reappointment, she could have her tenure extended for another 5 years, but the ANC is very opposed to that, and that will be a huge loss because there are very few other institutions that citizens trust. And yes, we have to accept and acknowledge that there are these challenges if we're going to prevent any further deterioration. And I mean, for us, that's the fight, that's the commitment, that's where the community activism has to be focused.
Yeah, are there any more questions? Would you like to make some comments? Then I'll make a couple of comments. In this session we went to cases, national cases, but what we could see, as I said in a moment ago, is that the institution, the commissions, with their limited mandate and extremely high hopes, because the mandate is limited to time and type of crime, the hopes are is that with the work, democracy will shine, peace will come, social justice will be enhanced, etc., etc. So there is something there that is a misfit, in a sense. But I would say that perhaps the misfit goes a little bit beyond. I think TRCs have been extremely important, and the last comment about opening opportunities for other actors to participate in the public sphere is something which we usually do not look at, but I think it's perhaps the key, that it's open. It's a state recognition that something was wrong, and we have cases where the state never recognized that something was wrong, so with no TRC, TRC indicates that something was wrong, and so there is an opening of the political space and the political opportunity for various types of actors to come out and say, look, I'm here. Empowerment of various sorts, including the issue of the silenced populations. I think women have been, and women, gender-specific violations have been rather silenced. And there is a move that comes after the commissions of people demanding attention to other types of violations and other types of crimes. Yet, at the same time, there is a problem with the notion of transitional justice. Are we always in transition? Do we need the notion of transitional justice, which is different from other types of justice? Is Canada in transition, that we needed one of the institutions that emerged in the world as an institution of transitional justice to emerge in Canada? That is, I would say that in the world we face inequalities, we face violence, we face exclusion, and there are some experiments at institutions, at practices, to try to come to grips with those inequalities and those violations. Commissions is one of them. It's a much broader spectrum of institutions and of practices that we have to face, and commissions, as I say, is only one little part. But to put a frame and say transitional justice is again putting the notion that you have a limited time frame, and social processes and historical processes do not have this limited time frame. So I think that it's there that we have some kind of problem, of conceptual problem, in handling what is a truth commission, what is transitional justice, and does it apply only to, up to now, the third world? And perhaps Canada is the first case in which a developed country applies an institution coming from the south to a country in the north. But is transitional justice only an issue of underdeveloped or developing world, or is it more an issue that we should look at in the world context as a whole? So those are some of the questions that are raised for me, at least, when thinking of these issues. So if there are no further comments, I thank everybody for this session, and we're finished exactly in time. And now it's lunchtime, I think. Lunch break.